Well, good morning again. Jesus feeding the 5,000 is one of the few stories that occurs in all four Gospels. And that should probably tell us that there is something very significant about it. But I don't know about you. When every time I approach this this episode of this story, I find myself just going, I'm missing something. I'll tell you why. Jesus says, when his disciples realize, these people are going to be hungry, and the last thing we want is a really large crowd that's hungry, for obvious reasons. Jesus says to his disciples, you give them something to eat. Why? I have no idea. Nobody does. It's just not clear what he means by that, because I think it's safe to assume that Jesus does not expect his disciples to be able to accomplish much of anything. They're able to scrounge up 3 loaves of bread and 2 fish. That's very specific and a consistent detail, which leads us to ask, what does that mean? Is there something behind that? Some kind of symbolism? I don't know. Nobody knows. You can find people very hyper-spiritualizing it, but it's one of those things where you just kind of roll your eyes and move on. 5 plus 2 does equal 7 for the math whizzes out there. 7 is a very significant number. But I don't know, what do we do with that then? The other detail that we get is that there are 5,000 men, because back in that era, you'd count the men. That's just how they did it. I'm not saying it's right. Don't shoot the messenger. What's the significance of 5,000? No idea. It makes it easy to remember in English, the feeding of the 5,000. But otherwise, we just don't know. In other words, there's often going to be some kind of symbolism or deeper meaning behind the miracles that Jesus performs. Like when he tells a guy who has a hand that doesn't work, and he says, stretch it out. And it's a miracle, it works, but it was done on the Sabbath. So the message there isn't just that Jesus is powerful, but also that he has some kind of authority that allows him to do this on the holiest day of the week. There's more going on to that story. In this case, there doesn't seem to be anything. Which is why, for me, this story always just falls flat. I never know what to do with it. But I think there's more going on here, because we're jumping into this story in the middle. It's like coming into a three-act play about, somewhere halfway between, or halfway in the middle of the second act. There's some other stuff happening. And you can get that sense at the beginning of the reading, because Matthew tells us, now when he heard this, Jesus withdrew and took his disciples. Which leads us to yet another question. Heard what? What did he hear? Because that seems significant. As it turns out, there was a party, a birthday party, thrown by Herod Antipas, sometimes also known as Herod the Tetrarch. He is one of the sons of Herod the Great, who, if you know anything about the history of that era and in that region, was the opposite of great. He's the Herod that tried to kill a bunch of children in an effort to get at Jesus when he was born. We usually read that during Christmas time. So his son, Herod Antipas, or Herod the Tetrarch, throws a birthday party. And he's got all of his military leaders, and it's lavish and probably very exciting and probably over the top and included all kinds of things that I'm not going to say because then they won't let me be your pastor anymore. And during the course of this this party, a young woman performs a dance. We don't know much about that dance. I'm not really sure what it would have looked like. We know from other sources her name was Salome. And Herod Antipas appreciated this dance quite a bit. You can fill in a couple of lines, maybe. And so he offers her, in response to this, anything she wants up to half his kingdom. Now, this is an ancient Middle Eastern culture. You show your sincerity by exaggerating. It's like when Zacchaeus decides he's going to give back everything he's cheated people out of, you know, and pay them back like four times over. He's showing how sincere he is. Now, this young woman doesn't really know how to respond, but her mother does. Now, there's more to it than that. Her mother, whose name is escaping me at the moment, received criticism from John the Baptist because she was shacking up with Herod Antipas, even though she was at the time married to Herod Antipas' brother named Philip. Remember Maury Povich or Jerry Springer, that show? Just fits right in. And I also like to say, if you think your family's dysfunctional, guess what? Years down the road, Salome ends up becoming her own great aunt. That's all I'll say. Yeah. As you can imagine, she and Herod Antipas did not appreciate John the Baptist's criticism. And in part, John's criticism is because Herod's ideal, his goal was to gain the title that his father had, which was King of the Jews. And if he's going to have that title, you can't be doing that sort of thing. So Herod did what, of course, any Herod would do. They threw John the Baptist in prison. But Herod had always kind of respected John the Baptist. It was apparently quite obvious to everybody who came in contact with him that John the Baptist was a prophet. And Jesus will essentially call him the last of the great prophets. And so, yeah, he'll lock him up just to shut him up, but at the same time, he wants him around. Herod's mistress, girlfriend, it's bugging me that I can't remember her name, she wanted John the Baptist gone. And so when her daughter is given such a generous offer, she then says to her daughter, "Tell him you want the head of John the Baptist on a plate." Now, we have an honor-shame issue here because this guy, in front of his generals, King Herod, or Herod the Tetrarch, rather, had given this big public pronouncement that he's going to give her anything she wants, and when she says it, he has to do it. He cannot incur the shame of not doing it. So Herod the Baptist is executed by beheading, and his head is brought into that party. Now imagine the party. There's all the kinds of food that you would want, or would want if you lived in the first century in the ancient world. All the wine you can drink, apparently some dancing. I'll spare the details. It's a big deal. It's lavish. It's debaucherous. It's all kinds of chaos. And not only that, but the party has this undertone of violence because there's the head of John the Baptist. John's disciples took his body and then buried him. Word gets to Jesus. Now, Jesus has a very special relationship with John the Baptist. They are in some way related. I don't think cousin is the right word, although I remember that getting tossed around when I was a kid. They are related in some way. John himself was the first to go public with his career. And he gathered disciples, and he had a teaching ministry, and he started doing these weird things where he would immerse people in the Jordan River as a way of symbolizing when ancient Israel crossed through the Jordan to reach the land that God gave them. John was the one who essentially kicked it off when Jesus went public. Because he baptized Jesus. And it's clear that John knows exactly who Jesus is. Now, if you kind of read in between the lines a little bit, that essentially makes John Jesus' rabbi. Every rabbi has a rabbi. Every teacher has a teacher. And based on a couple of clues that Jesus leaves us with, that's John. It means they have a very special relationship. So Jesus gets word. Hey, John has been executed. If you have a very special relationship with somebody, and I'm willing to bet everyone here does, and you learn that they have died unexpectedly, what's the first thing you want to do? I'm out of here. I'm gone. Like, if I'm going to be with people, I need to be with like three people that I know are able to handle these sorts of things, but otherwise I'm out. That's what I do. As a pastor, I won't go into the details. There are certain things that if I experience, I know that my day is done. Certain kinds of tragedies that I can get exposed to. I know after that, I don't care what I have scheduled. I'm out because I need to take some time away. And honestly, I would encourage you to do the same if you need that. So Jesus finds out that his close friend John has been executed. And so he withdraws. He takes his 12. They get into a boat and they leave. That makes perfect sense. But then the people hear about it. They figure out where Jesus is. This is before people posted everything on social media. So you can figure out exactly where they are at all times. Which to me is weird because it's always like, hey, I'm out of town on this thing, which that seems to tell me, hey, you could rob me and I'm not going to know for a couple of days. But word gets out that Jesus has left, and so the people find him. And it's not a small group of people, it's a lot of people. Put yourself in Jesus' shoes for a minute. You are crushed. And yet a whole bunch of people in desperate need are coming to you because they know that whatever it is that you have, they need. Jesus then has compassion. He has compassion on the people, and he spends the time to heal them, spends the time to minister to them, and spends the time to feed them. Any idea how long it'd take 12 people to distribute food to 9,000? Wow. Which tells us on the one hand that Jesus is made of something that I am not. And you are not. To have that kind of emotional strength and depth. And Matthew is very very intent on showing how Jesus would step away and spend time with the Father. There's a special connection there that he draws on and allows them to do great things in spite of exhaustion. It shows that he's generous with what he has. I don't know about you, but sometimes I feel like I irritate God. We all have the thought patterns and sins that we all kind of constantly return to because that's part of what it means to be human. And there's usually a point where in my own kind of tortured frustration, I feel like I'm bothering God. I'm exhausting him. Because every example of somebody who loves me, and I'm fortunate, I could name many people who love me, I know I could push them to their limits pretty quick. Every example of love that I've experienced and every example of love that you have experienced, although it may, in an ideal sense, be unconditional, will have its limits because they are human. That's how it works. Everyone has their breaking point. Jesus apparently does not. That is good news. That is really good news. Because no matter how broken or how frustrated I am with myself, how much of a mess I can make of my life, how much of a mess you can make of your life, and it being kind of our own faults, Jesus isn't ever going to get tired of us. That's good news. One final thought, and I'll end here. By this point in Jesus' career, he's already started to show his cards about how this is going to end up. He is here proclaiming and enacting the kingdom of God, the very presence of God. And that was essentially a power play. Everyone knows the presence of God is in Jerusalem in the temple. And that's carefully cultivated by a group of very powerful priests who abuse that power relentlessly. And Jesus flat out tells his disciples that when he gets to Jerusalem, it is not going to go well for him. They don't really understand it, but Jesus sees it coming. I'd be willing to bet that when Jesus finds out that his friend John has been executed, in the back of his mind, it's a reminder that his time is coming too. And yet he feeds the people in need. That's the kind of guy I can get behind. Amen.